is 8:30, and you are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. And we are joined once again by Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. How are you both this morning?
Frosty Great. The snowman is very, very soft.
I'm shivering.
Good. It's our little way of...
Keeping it too cold in here.
It is a way of telling that it is a live interview as opposed to being done over the phone.
Well, I just don't want you guys, you know, falling asleep. And I've heard one of the best ways of doing that until you hit a certain extreme temperature is to keep things cold.
Yeah, you start feeling warm and cozy, and then you nod off, and then next thing you know, you wake up in
then?
The Pentagon war room,
or behind our building back on Aurora,
or indefinite detention.
that's very much a possibility.
Well, that's a possibility no matter what the temperature is here.
That could be a possibility by the time the reggae folks get here.
So let's jump into this week's events. Very good news from our courts, our fine Washington State courts.
The one branch of government that still seems to have some independence and life to them. But they were about 7 or 8 years behind the times, because I have no idea why this ruling did not come down the pike, before the first re-election, if ever, of Mark Sidran. We had a court ruling. It actually happened a couple of weeks ago, but was not made public until early last week, that Mark Sidran and the city of Seattle's ban on posters on utility poles, telephone poles, etc., was unconstitutional. That area constituted a traditional public forum, and therefore the city did not have the right to ban posters that advertise, you know, upcoming political events, bands, lost puppies, garage sales, all of the things that you see in most cities as part of sort of a vibrant community that gives you evidence that people are actually out there doing things for people who cannot afford to advertise their garage sales or upcoming shows or political events on television or radio in a major market, which is almost all of us until you get up to, you know, events at Pier 66 or the Key Arena or the Gorge. It is long, long overdue. I've never understood why that was not overturned early on. The argument of Mark Sidran and then Mayor Norm Rice and a majority of the then very downtown centric Seattle Council was that these posters presented health hazards to utility workers. Oddly enough, you have not been hearing that argument recently, maybe because the number of deaths by utility workers from, you know, pieces of paper stuck to utility poles has not in fact plummeted since the ban has taken place. We have enough statistics over enough of a period of years now that we have come to the rational conclusion that when you have zero deaths to begin with, there's really not very far for it to fall. So we have that freedom now, and we have any number of things right now in the city of Seattle where both locally and nationally and internationally where there are very compelling reasons to get out and bring messages to the public. So we have in this city, I don't think it will take long to get into the habit again, but I would strongly suggest, and in fact I made the suggestion at Seattle Weekly this week, and I think they will probably go up on it, where, you know, we just go out and plaster the city with posters announcing that it's okay to put posters up on utility poles. We need to get in the habit once again of, you know, getting out there and using that as a public forum and using that as a way to deliver messages to the public, because, you know, we're not going to be able to get them on our local TV stations quite as easily as you can go out there with a staple gun or some tape or whatnot. And of course, you know, if you do have events, if you do have shows, if you do whatever, go out and take the posters down when you're done with them. I mean, you know, clean up after yourself, because part of the anger that led to the public acceptability of that kind of a law in the first place was people being slobs about it. So let's, you know, be a little smarter this time around, not take the risk that that's going to be politically acceptable in the future, because as we've seen in the last year, free speech and some of the other things that are guaranteed by the Bill of Rights are not always things that the public rallies around, regardless of the situation. So, you know, at least not all of the public. So we need to exercise that right vigilantly, and it's, you know, sort of the use it and lose it thing. So get your staple guns out and let's go to it.
Woohoo. All right, moving along.
Yeah. I got to find my staple gun. It's been buried in a box somewhere for a while.
All right. Moving along, they covered Counterspin, covered it a bit, but it looks like the lead guy for America's Most Wanted has some competition. John Ashcroft wants to take the show over or something.
Well, actually, they're good buddies. If for people who have ever not seen the television program America's Most Wanted and what we're talking about here, for folks who just tuned in or weren't listening during that segment of Counterspin, my colleague at In These Times, a guy named Dave Lindorf, wrote an article last Monday in Salon.com for people who haven't looked it up. It is on the Salon Premium. You have to pay a few nickels for it, but it is worth it. It's called America's what was it? The name of the I forget the name of the article, but you'll find it. Essentially, what happened is Dave did something that many reporters don't do anymore. He asked a simple question and then tried to find out the answer. In this case, when Operation Tips, the John Ashcroft's citizen spying on citizen program, was announced about a month and a half ago now, Dave went out and signed up for it. He goes to the website, and you sign up and say, I want to become a citizen informant, because he wanted to find out how it worked and what happens when you actually sign up for the program, what you're told by our government. And he didn't hear anything for a long time, didn't hear anything for about a month. And finally, when he did, they gave him a number. So he calls up the number to, find out what happens when you inform on your fellow citizens. And it was not a trained FBI specialist during, an elite counterterrorism squad. It was a receptionist at the Fox television program, America's Most Wanted. For anybody who's never seen it, there are people out there who don't watch television all day and all evening. It is tabloid television at its worst. It's basically the host, John Walsh, is this very cheap, fraudulent imitation of John Wayne. It's kind of a bad parody where he sits there, arms akimbo on his hips and legs astride, talking about how we're gonna catch the bad guys and nab those bastards and put them away, and it's a love fest with the FBI, of course, and with police all the time. And it's basically, for the limited amount of good that it does, because occasionally they do, they probably get a trillion tips from viewers, and probably about three of them a year actually wind up catching wanted criminals. But any good that it does is far outweighed by the bad that it promotes, because it promotes this paranoid worldview to a lot of its viewers that they're the only thin line that's separating hordes of rapists and murderers from overrunning God-fearing Americans' suburban homes. The only thing that's protecting them is their guns and the police, and of course, watching lots of evening tabloid television. So now you have the Operation Tips program, and apparently once Dave started asking questions and then broke his story, he started calling people at the Department of Justice and other places to find out whether this was actual policy, and people claimed they didn't know anything about it, and then suddenly the phone calls were directed to somebody at the FBI rather than Fox Television. But the scary thing about this, there are a number of things about it, and I won't go into all the implications, because some of them are obvious and some of them Dave covered in the last segment when he was interviewed. But the scariest part is that Dick Armey's legislation, which is in the House bill, which may or may not get approved by the Senate. It's a good time, by the way, to call Senators Patty Murray and Maria Cantwell and demand that the Senate stick in version in its legislation as well that would ban Operation Tips, and that the conference committee, the joint conference committee that will resolve differences between the two pieces of legislation, also ban the Operation Tips program. But obviously Operation Tips has already started without waiting for congressional approval, number one. And then number two, the language of the legislation that Army has in the House version talks about the government not running any program that has citizens spying upon citizens. Well, if you're directing tips to a private for-profit agency, because that's what Fox Television is, it's not, this benevolent public nonprofit. They're out to make money by attracting viewers to their television program and then selling those viewers to advertisers. You get around that restriction. But what you wind up with is a program that John Ashcroft would be setting up, where he is encouraging tens of millions of Americans to be participating in a private, for-profit, vigilante program. That that you're encouraging all of these millions of Americans to rat on each other, send the information to you know, some receptionist at a studio office in New York, that information is going God only knows where, being used for God only knows what purpose, and there is absolutely zero public accountability to it. The potential for abuse and misuse is tremendous, and you're getting around any restrictions because it's not a government program. It's all being privately done, being by a corporation. Very, very frightening stuff.
It also makes it a farce, the government's claim that a lot of the information that they're getting from people that they're holding indefinitely as material witnesses, that they can't charge these people in court or take them to trial because the information that they have is confidential. I mean, it makes that claim ridiculous.
Yeah.
Because if you have a tip about a possible terrorist and you're giving it to Fox TV, I mean, that's not it's confidential
information. It's obviously not something you're withholding from the public. Yeah.
I know.
I mean, let alone the fact that the secretary at Fox TV is not, you know, does not have top secret security
clearance.
Does not
have a security clearance,
but,
that's
but
right.
But beyond that, if Fox TV gets a really juicy tip, they're not going to hold it to themselves. They're going to broadcast it in prime time.
Exactly.
So it's pretty ridiculous from that segment
it
also.
It kind of smacks of like World War II propaganda in a way. A sort of propaganda exercise to get Americans behind the war on terrorism. I really think that's what it is, more than anything.
Very, very much so. I think that was one of the big purposes of Operation Tips to begin with, is to, number one, normalize the idea that everybody should be afraid, everybody should be looking over their shoulder, and the only people that can be trusted is Big Brother. But beyond that, normalize the idea that we're going to be in this permanent war. And obviously, if that's going to be a propaganda effort, what better partner in crime than a tabloid television program?
Yeah, exactly. But I have a tip for America's Most Wanted. Maybe if I phoned it in, they'd do something about it, because the FBI sure isn't. It's been well known for a while now, for at least a couple of months, if not for 6 to 9 months, that the FBI has a credible suspect for the anthrax letters. I've mentioned it before on this program that the FBI now knows from analysis of the anthrax spores that the anthrax came from a U.S. government research lab, either the Dugway Proving Grounds in Utah or Fort Detrick in Maryland, and more likely it was Fort Detrick in Maryland. And it's now... I've now seen a lot of information, read a lot of information about this suspect and about his background, and I've also been reading information from other bioterrorism experts and bioweapons and experts that they really think this is the guy who did it, and they really believe now that the FBI is dragging its feet because this man has close connections to the CIA and has worked for a government contractor that has done contract work for the CIA. The man's name is Stephen Hatfill. His home has been searched 3 times by the FBI. He's been questioned 4 times. He now has 2 lawyers that he has hired. There is just a ton of circumstantial evidence. The man is very, very intelligent. Of course, like a lot of, he's a virologist, but he has worked for the government on biological weapons programs. A lot of those people
with top secret security clearance.
Yeah, a lot of those people are very, very intelligent and have multiple degrees, as Hatfill does. So he's not a lone nut sitting in a cabin in the woods somewhere cooking up anthrax in his oven and sealing it into envelopes and sending it out. I mean, this guy has access to hot labs where anthrax can be made in the very, very virulent form, the very, very potent form that was seen in the letter sent to Tom Daschle. And in fact, that form was so strong and so potent that the people who analyzed it were shocked at what they saw. They did not think anthrax could be that pure. They did not think it could be made in that form. And as they analyzed it, they had to bring in a man who has been in charge of the anthrax program in the U.S. government, developing anthrax weapons that could be analyzed and could be taken apart and that they could be tested to see, vaccines could be tested for that kind of weaponized anthrax. This man developed a new way to weaponize anthrax to make it extremely potent. They had to bring him in to look at it and to verify that, yes, this is what was done to this anthrax strain. It was weaponized using the technique that this man developed. And that narrowed down the number of suspects considerably And Dr. Hatfill, Stephen Hatfill, is a colleague of this man and has worked with him.
I could just see the scenario. Oh, that looks like Steve's work.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's amazing. And what's come out of this is questions like, how come, for example, that the two top people in bioweapons, to the two top bioweapons experts in the U.S. were not questioned by the FBI until recently about the anthrax? You know, how come the FBI has not looked at the logs for the hot labs, the few that exist in the U.S. where a weapon this potent could be made? You know, why is the FBI dragging its feet on this? And it's become very apparent that they are. Now, I think there's two reasons for that. The first reason is they want to keep secret the fact that the U.S. has a bioweapons program. Now, the U.S. signed on to a protocol in 1972, a U.N. treaty that banned the development of biological weapons. And when we signed that treaty, Richard Nixon, who was president at the time, gave the order to destroy our stocks of biological weapons. Well, that wasn't completely done. Some were destroyed and some weren't. That's become very apparent now.
And this is all through Democratic and Republican administrations.
Yes, exactly.
This is not simply the Bush administration thumbing its nose at international treaties.
Right, no. This was the Nixon administration, the Ford administration, Carter, Reagan, Bush Sr., the Clinton administration. These programs have been continuing, and they've been receiving a lot of funding, and they've been very, very, very secret. But they're starting to become less secret because the people who work on those programs are concerned now. They have seen that one of the first major attacks, biological attacks against the American people, has been perpetrated by an insider of the U.S. bioweapons program, and that has concerned them, and they're starting to talk now about the kind of research that they're doing and the kind of programs that the U.S. government has sponsored.
And you might want to talk a little bit about the motivation of why that particular attack could have taken place.
Yeah. Well, but right now, the point that I want to make is that the Bush administration is fueling up for a war against Iraq, and the reasons for the war against Iraq supposedly are that Iraq is trying to acquire and assemble and use biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons, and that they would, if we don't attack them now, they're going to spread it all over the Third World and all over the Middle East and allow terrorists to have this technology, etc. Well, I've been doing a lot of reading on the background of Dr. Hatfill, who has worked for white supremacist governments in Rhodesia in the 70s, in South Africa in the 80s, and he has trained right-wing militias in South Africa to assassinate anti-apartheid activists throughout the early 1990s, and who, fresh from that experience, came to the U.S. and began working immediately in the U.S. government's bioterrorism, bioweapons facilities. And I've been reading a lot about his background, and it really exposes the fact that the U.S. is the main nation that spreads bioweapons and chemical weapons and nuclear weapons around the world. It's quite obvious that that's where South Africa got much of its seed stock for its biological weapons program, was the U.S. and Britain. And so that's a history that the U.S. government does not want people to know about. They do not want to know about that at all. And, of course, the last thing that George W. Bush and company want is for people to be talking about where Iraq got its biological weapons in the first place, which was from South Africa, and they got their stock from us.
Yeah, and so. Then the reason I was mentioning the motivation is because one of the allegations around Hatfill is that he began working for a private consultant to the basically the defense industry, one of the allegations is that one of the motivations for the attack was to drum up support within the U.S. government after September 11th for spending more money on prevention of bioterror.
Although
is that Dr. been superseded?
Actually, Dr. Hatfill, it was widely reported in press accounts that he was responsible for commissioning on his own a study of sending anthrax spores through the mail as a biological weapons attack. He actually did not commission that study on his own. His company was working for the CIA at the time. So it was the CIA that... And this did not come out through press reports. This was not told to the press. This was well known among biological weapons experts. People who work in the industry have now come forward and said, no, at the time, Dr. Hatfield was working for a contractor, subcontractor for the CIA. That's come from his colleagues have said that. And it has not been spread through the U.S. media, and it should be, because if that report was commissioned by the CIA, then the U.S. government is directly responsible for Dr. Hatfield's, what anything that Dr. Hatfield has done, including these current anthrax attacks. And they should then go after this man, but they're not.
Yeah.
And it's because they're protecting him.
Yeah, the direction I was going with that is it seems very, very circular in a lot of ways, that the United States is spreading a lot of this weapon, these types of weapons around the world, both directly and indirectly, because the existence of their program also inspires countries, even countries that aren't getting their seed stock from the United States, to start their own in response, both because they see the United States thumbing international law and because they want to protect themselves. But at the same time, the United States is pointing at these countries as justification for attacking them, but it's also using it as justification for developing its own program. So
exactly.
it feeds on itself.
One of the top two experts in the U.S. bioweapons program, a man named Ken Alabek, is a former... He was the number two man in the Soviets. He was formerly a Soviet citizen. He was the number two man in the Soviet biological weapons program.
That sounds like an update to the old Nazi war criminals after World War II coming to work
for the
CIA.
The U.S. government goes around and recruits these people, as they recruited Dr. Hatfield from South Africa. Obviously, they recruited Dr. Alabek. Dr. Alabek really believes that the FBI is dragging its feet as well. He's one of the men who was puzzled because the FBI never came to him and never asked him, because he has expertise on the difference between U.S. anthrax stocks and Soviet anthrax stocks. And if it had been an attack by terrorists who would have gotten the anthrax spores from the Soviet Union or from a researcher at a Soviet program, a former researcher at a Soviet program, he would have been able to tell that by looking at the anthrax. He would have been able to give them that kind of advice, but they never asked him.
All right. Well, it sounds like, because the anthrax story was so hot there for a while and then cooled off, that luckily we have a really good inoculation program with our press here in the U.S., and we nipped that one in the bud right away.
Well, one of the things that we're looking at with all this this run-up for the attack on Iraq right now is, we have to invade Iraq, We need to invade Washington, D.C.
We need to launch an invasion
to, number one, where all of the war criminals are, in terms of developing the chemical and biological weapons programs, in terms of the nuclear stock, in terms of intervention in countries around the world, supporting of dictators, arms trade, training secret police, yada, 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 in terms of the corporate control, and in terms of our own loss of democracy, that these people are unaccountable. They're keeping heinous secrets from the American people. And, if we're going to launch an attack on anywhere, we should be launching attacks on people that are taking our basic rights to representative democracy away from us, and that's not Saddam Hussein.
And speaking of which, at the same time that Stephen Hatfield is running around the country, and the scariest part about him, by the way, is not that he's an anthrax expert, he has worked with anthrax, but he is a virologist. His expertise is in working with the Ebola virus, which is what he worked on when he was working at USAMRID, the U.S. government labs, from 1997 to 99. They gave him free run of the Ebola labs, so I want to know what he was working on there. But while he is running free, able to do another anthrax attack anytime he wants to, the FBI has... They have arrested and put into indefinite detention James Ujamaa. People who have been following that, James Ujamaa is an activist and a black Muslim, a member of the Seattle African American community. Maybe you recall that he was considered the guy who was trying to set up a terrorist training camp in Bly, Oregon.
Yeah.
People should check
out... According to stories that were leaked by the Seattle Times and a reporter who is said to be very close to the Bush administration.
Right, and people should check out the article in the PI yesterday that basically shows that James Ujamaa was trying to set up a kind of a little vacation camp to get people of the Muslim faith here in the U.S. to spend their time doing the ultimate jihad challenge, coming to Oregon, riding horses, shooting some AK-47s, and having a good time pretending that they were part of the jihad.
What paramilitary folks do on right-wing camps.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's a farce. I mean, they're holding James Ujamaa as a material witness, and he's not responsible really for anything, you know. And they're letting somebody like Stephen Hatfill run around free. I don't understand.
Yeah. And I want to say very, very briefly one other note on the Ujamaa story. It is illustrative of something that we don't notice too often with two newspapers in this city. We have the Times on the one hand who's trying to railroad this guy, and the PI who's trying to point out how ridiculous it is. They are actually competing with one another, and that is something that you do not have in most communities in this country
anymore. The PI is actually interviewed some people who had been down to the ranch, which is one of the differences, too, between the two.
Yeah, it's but I mean, we've got the National Association of Broadcasters coming into town next month, and we'll, I'm sure, be talking about that in future weeks on this program. But one of the criticisms that is going to be leveled when you have protests and the Reclaim the Media conference going on side by side is the hegemony over media right now, and the fact that programs like America's Most Wanted have unaccountable, unchallenged soapboxes and can launch propaganda campaigns. We have two newspapers in this city that can actually counter one another when a story like this comes up. You don't have that with most media in this country. It's very, very scary, the potential for abuse, because if the Seattle Times were our only newspaper, that's all we would know about James Ujamaa.
All right. I'm pretty sure that the Ultimate Jihad Challenge is on right after America's Most Wanted now on Fox, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, actually. And then Wheel of Fortune comes on right
Wheel
after that.
Wheel of Misfortune, yeah. Yes. Okay. Real quickly, there's a couple, several important things coming up next week.
Yeah, we talked about Iraq, and one of the most compelling people who can talk about the actual reality of weapons programs in Iraq is a person who was a very high-ranking United Nations official who quit his job running the Food for Oil program, as did another person in the program, Dennis Holliday, Hans von Spanik. He was in town a few months ago. He'll be back in town speaking Tuesday night, August 13th, at the University Temple United Methodist Church on 43rd and University Way. That is, I believe, at 7 o'clock.
And Hans von Spanik, by the way, is the man who recently said that the Oil for Food program had been abused by the U.S. government to get information on the Iraqi government unrelated to weapons of mass destruction or the Oil for Food program.
Yeah,
so
they were spying.
He's a good guy to go and see.
Yeah, and very, very timely, obviously, with that threat. Tomorrow afternoon, for folks who want something fun to do tomorrow, go over to Yakima, because the annual Farm Workers Festival for Justice and Legalization, the big, big event that goes on each year over in central Washington, there are buses from Seattle. A bus leaves at 10 a.m. from the park and ride at I-5 and 85th in and 65th, I'm sorry, in Seattle for a $25 donation. So be sure to go over and see the window to that part of the world, because it's something we do not pay attention to or give support to nearly enough in Seattle. And then lastly, and also very importantly, on Monday, we haven't had a chance to talk about it this week, but the ILWU, the longshoremen, may be going out on strike soon. There is a very real threat that if they do, George Bush will send in the National Guard. Very, very frightening possibility of nationalizing the ports on the West Coast. There will be a rally to demand no federal interference into the negotiations and obviously support for the workers themselves on the docks. That will be on Monday, 2:30 at Pier 37, 4:30 a march north on Alaskan Way, and then at 5 o'clock for people just getting off work, 5 o'clock on Monday, a rally at Pier 66, the cruise terminal down on the waterfront.
Very good. So very full schedule for everyone. On top of what we all normally do.
Yeah, hopefully you don't have a job or anything like that. I mean, you know, our family or kids.
Well, the beauty of the current economy is more and more people don't have to worry about that job thing.
Lots of free time, that's right.
All right, talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, who are co-editors at Eat the State, and Maria, tell us about Eat the State.
Eat the State is a biweekly newspaper. You can find it in bookstores, cafes, coffee shops, bars, restaurants all over town. You can check us out on the web at www.eatthestate, all one word, eatthestate.org. We should have the current issues posted. We didn't for a while, but we should have them posted up now. And
and we'll be out there catching the bad guys.
If you have a tip for us, you can call us.
You can
call our tips line at 903-9461.
We have sophisticated anti-terrorist operators standing by.